We open Fresh Air today with a 1945 recording of How High the Moon, featuring the Al Casey Sextet, with Willie Smith on alto saxophone and Illinois Jacquette on tenor. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Dr. Sidney Wolfe, who in 1971 co-founded with Ralph Nader the Public Citizens Health Research Group. They conduct research into the health and safety of foods, medicines, and workplaces. Wolfe is the co-author of the new book, Over-the-Counter Drugs That Don't Work. We'll open up the phones when he joins us at 4 o'clock and discuss over-the-counter pills. With me now on Fresh Air is Petra Kelly, one of the leaders of West Germany's Green Party. The Green Party is opposed to nuclear weapons and nuclear power. They support nonviolence, ecology, feminism, and third world liberation movements. Petra Kelly has described the Greens' ultimate goals as creating a decentralized, democratic, nonviolent society. Many members of the Greens are part of a countercultural movement which has been compared to the 1960s American counterculture. The Greens won their first parliamentary seats in last March's election. Petra Kelly is one of three Green speakers in Parliament in West Germany. 28 Greens are now in Parliament. West German President Karl Karstens is visiting Philadelphia today with U.S. Vice President George Bush to celebrate the tricentennial of German emigration to Philadelphia and America. A coalition of West German and American peace and religious groups have planned an alternate celebration. Bush and Karstens represent to them the planned deployment this fall of NATO nuclear missiles in West Germany. Tonight, this coalition will hold a witness for friendship without missiles. This anti-nuclear demonstration will emphasize that the first German emigres to America were religious, peace-oriented groups like the Quakers and the Mennonites. Petra Kelly is in Philadelphia to speak at this witness. It will be held this evening at the Art Museum steps from 7:30 to 9:30. Other West German and American peace activists will speak. For more information, you can call 568-0917. That's 568-0917. This event will be covered by the West German and American press. Petra Kelly is a founding member of the Greens and the former chair of the party. In February, she organized the Green International Tribunal against first strike and mass destructive weapons in the West and the East. She's been active in the European anti-nuclear and feminist movement since 1970. Her mother is German, her father a retired U.S. Army lieutenant colonel. Her parents live in Virginia, and you may have read an article about her in this morning's Philadelphia Inquirer. Petra Kelly, welcome to Fresh Air and to Philadelphia.
Thank you.
German-U.S. relations are getting a lot of attention now because of this tricentennial of German immigration. What does today's visit of Karl Karstens, West Germany's president, to Philadelphia represent to you?
Well, it's an act of hypocrisy in a way because he's coming on a day called the 6th of October when 300 years ago, people who have been tortured, who have been put to death, who have been put at the stake, had in fact left Europe, left Holland, left Germany to come to the United States to kind of find their religious freedom because they were draft and war resistors. And he's not mentioning that. He is coming to show that the military alliance called NATO and the friendship between the military is going to make more friendship between the two countries, and he is ignoring the entire issue, the spiritual roots of the Mennonites and the Quakers. And so I find the visit added with warships and maneuvers and air shows is quite a hypocrisy to the spiritual roots of the Mennonites and the Quakers.
NATO plans to deploy missiles in West Germany this fall.
Yes.
Why are you opposed to that deployment?
Well, we have many, many reasons, of course, to have We have awoken very abruptly since the decision of Mr. Helmut Schmidt to accept those missiles on German soil in 1979. These are first strike weapons. These are going to be used in one way you can use them. You can, in fact, strike out surgically the entire military command structure of the Soviet Union in the western part of the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe. These are first use and first strike missiles because if you don't use them, you will lose them. They are on the open ramp, and if you don't shoot them out first, the other side will preventively try to knock them out. And they're very dangerous because they create a second Cuba missile crisis for Europeans. There are now weapons put on the mainland of Europe, Pershing only in Germany, reaching the Soviet Union with in 8 minutes, and that is a very dangerous situation.
I think a lot of Americans feel that you should feel more secure with the presence of NATO missiles on your soil because it means that you're protected. You have a system by which you could fight back.
Well, it's not so. If you look at the testimonies of Admiral Rickover, a very respected man in the military, who says at one point it makes no more sense, and if you start reading Mr. McNamara's statement, you realize that the more and more the overkill is increased, the less and less secure we are. Because if already the overkill is making us kill the other side and the other side killing us 13 to 14 times, then any reduction, even of one system, can't make us less secure. It just, in fact, reduces the overkill. So we feel perfectly safe. In fact, we feel now perfectly unsafe because already the amount of tactical sea, air and land-based systems on NATO's side are already so horrifying, as is also the other side horrifying. So we feel unilateral action is the only way to stop the arms race because we can't keep waiting always on the other side. We must begin it first.
I think some Americans also wonder why you and the Greens have been so outspoken against the deployment of NATO missiles when they haven't been hearing anything against Soviet missiles, which are targeted at European countries.
Well, we have, of course, been at the same time rather worried also about the SS-20 being built up to a degree that we can't accept. On the other hand, we have always clearly said that we do not want to make a connection to say Pershing 2 and cruise is a counterweight to SS-20. We have always said, regardless of whatever, unconditionally no deployment, and then clearly no SS-20, no SS-4, no SS-5, but also no Polaris, Poseidons, Tridents, because then Mr. Reagan has to start becoming honest when he's starting to count for his zero option. Zero option means for us no medium range, any type of weapon on both sides. What he is doing, in fact, is saying the one side that has 70% land potential should remove it, Soviet Union, while we on NATO remove not one weapon this fall. In fact, the only thing that is being removed, if it came to a zero option, would be that on paper. And now, of course, we realize that Geneva has failed, that we are actually facing deployment this fall and this winter instead of the men, those men who really are very incompetent, instead of them going on to discuss more and more, they in fact are ready to deploy.
This is impossible to measure, but do you have a sense of which missiles you feel more threatened by in West Germany?
Well, I think that, in fact, both sides are very frightening. I trust neither the Kremlin, I don't trust the White House either. I trust neither military bloc, but I feel that we have gone from deterrence, from war prevention, war preventing weapons, where we had a massive retaliation on both sides, trying to outdo the other side. We have gone to a new strategy, Cardis Directive 59, the selective strike and flexible response, and going to war making. Robert Scheer's book is one proof. Many of the documents of Mr. Weinberger, another proof, where in fact Weinberger has said we must have winnable, limited nuclear wars. And if I'm told, as I'm told on my trip, that the Americans cannot sacrifice Chicago for Hamburg, then exactly this is what's happening. They are willing to sacrifice Europe in a limited war, and the Russians, of course, might also sacrifice us. So in fact, later the two superpowers may call it off, but we Europeans have disappeared from the face of this earth, and that is why we are now taking to civil disobedience to stop this.
What actions do you have planned for the time of the planned deployment?
Well, we have planned a lot of actions in October, an action week. In fact, yesterday was the beginning of it when all of the labor unions called for a 5-minute work stoppage, 5 minutes to 12. In 90% of all factories, the work was stopped for 5 minutes. That's a very good beginning. We would like to see an hour strike. We would like to see a general strike because that is in the way that people, workers, could stop it. We feel that we're going to do in October a lot of hours of silence, joining hands between American bases, joining hands also between all atomic embassies, France, Great Britain, China, Soviet Union, America, and doing many civil disobedient actions of nonviolence, risking yourself, sitting, doing die-ins and sit-ins. And then there's going to be also Women's Day on the 17th of October, where women will do their own form of creativity and will take also to the streets in their own form of nonviolent action. But we must, of course, continue this into next year. This is only a very small beginning, and I feel it's like a drop on the hot stone. We have to go on and on planning strategies into next year.
What exactly is there an exact date for the deployment of the missiles?
Well, we feel that probably the Geneva talks will end by 15th of November, and that in fact then they will probably try to reduce it to a few less, and this will be the so-called partial solution, and it will be also very hypocritical. So we'll have probably the first cruise and some Pershings arriving at Greenham Common in Comiso, Italy, and some in Germany before Christmas. That will be the Christmas gift of NATO, and we will have to continue our opposition, of course, even more so then.
So you're planning the same tactics as
strategies
as more missiles.
Right. We have to continue because there's no way then to accept a partial solution. It's just as bad as a zero option.
Who have you been focusing on convincing of the need to keep the missiles out, the West Germans or the European countries who are members of the NATO alliance?
Well, we in fact tried to, first of all, appeal to our own government because Helmut Schmidt, the former chancellor and also our present chancellor have, of course, agreed to deploy. So we have collected 5 million verified signatures under the so-called Krefelder Appell against this deployment. We have tried to make many actions with our European friends in Holland, in Great Britain, in Belgium. And we, of course, have come to the United States, and also we have Americans coming to us, trying to show that the other America, we're in fact trying to also protect the soldiers, protect all the people misused in this, because many American soldiers are not very very happy about the deployment either. So we're trying to show that we in fact are in solidarity with all the people in this country who in fact understand our position.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Petra Kelly, who is a founding member of West Germany's Green Party, which is an ecological, feminist, and nonviolent party in Germany. She's also a speaker in the West German Parliament and is visiting today to speak this evening at The Witness, which is planned as an alternative to the festivities surrounding the visit of President Karl Carstens of West Germany. When U.S. Vice President George Bush recently visited Krefeld in Germany, also in celebration of German immigration to America, there was quite a demonstration against him. His motorcade was pelted with rocks and bottles. Was that organized by the Green Party?
I would have to first of all try to explain that day, because I happened to have been there the whole day. I was also at the so-called luncheon with Mr. Bush, and I appeared also trying to do a nonviolent action at the luncheon, which was prevented by his Secret Service in a not very nice way. There was a 40,000 nonviolent demonstration organized by the Green, by the Krefelder Appell, by many people, fully nonviolent. When we arrived in the morning, there was a violent outburst of about 100 or 150 persons, which was before Mr. Bush even had arrived. And I do not consider them part of the peace movement. If the peace movement turns violent, that is the death of the peace movement. But I must add that a big political scandal erupted 3 weeks later when one of those most violent involved, throwing bricks and rocks, was identified as a Secret Service agent from the West Berlin Secret Service. This is causing us to make very difficult thoughts about agent provocateur who in fact misused this movement, and the government has in fact made, as probably is well known here, made quite an example of this Krefeld and in fact has helped instigate it. So I remember the role of Martin Luther King and the FBI in this country, and I'm getting very worried about the role of such methods of the police to try to make us incredible, uncredible. So we have to really do much more nonviolent training, for any use of violence is completely, for us, useless. We would really lose the movement. And the Green Party is completely against any form of such violence.
Is there any way that you think the party can protect itself from penetration by either spies or provocateurs?
Well, the thing that we are trying to instigate in all of our different actions or try to initiate is to make many affinity groups, having groups of 10 or 20 who do nonviolent training. It's kind of followed by the American example, so we know exactly who we are and we get to know each other much better. But of course, it's no real protection. For if I just can remind you, 2 years ago in a very big scandal during the anti-nuclear movement in Göttingen, there were two policemen who had been identified after 2 years of working within that movement who had used all sorts of Molotov cocktails at a demonstration. So we had thought they were photographers of the anti-nuclear movement. So in fact, it is no protection. All you can do is you can only try to get to know one another so well, and you can try to do as much training as possible so it will not happen.
As of last March, Helmut Kohl is the Chancellor of West Germany and Karl Carstens the President. We've discussed their stand on the deployment of missiles, but in addition to that, what do their policies signify to you? Are there any that you support?
Well, Mr. Kohl has won in a kind of economic upswing. He didn't win on the missile issue, for he always has felt that his election's victory was a victory for the missiles. It was not so. He promised people an economic upswing. Well, he has done that for the industry, for the multinational companies. He's not done so for the women, for the old age pensioners, for the handicapped. And he is a very, I would say, very superficial chancellor who is very repressive in his policies. For his interior minister, Mr. Zimmermann, is using every possibility to try to stop democratic demonstrations, to try to stop nonviolent actions, and to call them violence. And Mr. Carstens is a man with a very strange and dark past. I am not proud to have him as my president of Germany. I'm ashamed of it as somebody coming from a post-war generation. I find it very difficult to see him come as the president of Germany. But the policies of the Christian Democrats in government are repressive legislation against women, against the peace movement, against draft resisters, against anyone who opposes their views. And at least there is some ray of hope when some of the Christian Democrats in that party are beginning to make a circle of Christian Democrats against the deployment. So at least we have some rays of hope that out of ethical, moral reasons, they are coming together to join the peace movement. There are not very many, but at least it's beginning.
Petra Kelly is my guest. She's a founding member of the Green Party in West Germany, and she's a speaker in West Germany's parliament. She was elected last March. Let's talk about the origins of the Green Party. What principles was it organized around?
Well, we were a very strong and large outer parliamentary movement, and many of us who began the Green Party, including myself, were in the Social Democratic Party, were disenchanted, dissatisfied, and we left, in fact, many of us in 78, 79. We began first as a coalition of feminist anti-war forces, ecological forces, as a political association. We ran for the European Parliament. We began at the level on the very top, and we ran in 1979 for European elections, getting 3.2%, over a million votes nearly. That was a very good result. And that day we decided then to become also a party, realizing we had to have the power structure of a party in the sense of being able to run in elections, because you cannot run as a loose coalition. This is only possible in the European context. So we ran in federal elections, regional elections. We were able to gain votes very quickly, in fact, amazingly very quickly. And we have been stabilizing at about 6 to 7% nationally. And it is a force where a conservative man or woman who is against any use of mass destructive weapons will join a feminist who is there for another reason, who will join an atheist who is there for another reason, and a Christian Democrat. So what you get, in fact, is people who have consensus on life and death issues, like genetic engineering, like on the issue of technology, like on the issue of feminism, like on the issue of equal rights and the issue of nuclear weapons. And because this consensus is there, we are able to keep these many, many people from many political corners together. What is very difficult, of course, is to try to continue in a party structure, because we have this try to bring the proof that we are effectively outer parliamentary and also effective in the parliament. So it's very taxing on those who try to play both roles. But it's a very important experiment, and it's an historical experiment, because it's the first time a party, or an anti-party party, as I call it, questions violence, structural violence. So the non-violent aspect is the most important aspect of this group.
It's, I think, difficult to remain a grassroots movement in an organized party.
Yes.
At the same time, what are some of the conflicts you've been running into in maintaining both of those roles?
Well, the first conflict is the incredible stress put upon people that they send into parliament to do both, to be at home at the grassroots and to be in parliament, to do suddenly always both. It's a 24-hour job. Also, the conflict that when you're offered to have assistance, you're offered to have part of the infrastructure to use that. We take the position also we must really become very realistic about using it for our good means, but only using also the good methods. And for example, we do not in any way accept any financial contributions from companies. We do not have anybody acting as a consultant. We try to reduce our salaries. We try to have a rotation term that's critical. We have to still discuss it in the Green Party. But we try to become as non-corruptible as possible. At the same time, we try also to have a very strong link to all the different groups at the grassroots. But the demands on a party of 28 members in parliament are so strong that if I look at my mail every day, which is 200 letters, I can see every common concern possible, and it's almost impossible to try to solve it because we are such a small group in the context of the whole system.
Are there methods of operating that you have to adapt in Parliament that you're not used to or that you'd rather not play by?
Well, we in fact are very stubborn, I think, the Green Party, and that's very good that they're stubborn, because we do have a lot of practice on the local level, on municipal levels, where we have come into city councils, into the regional parliaments. Many of the Green work very hard to try to learn the system and at the same time be able to expose it to the outside and show to the grassroots what corruption there is. We have exposed, for example, very successfully the scandal of the Flick company that has given over 800 million D-mark to the established parties to try to sway their opinion. We've tried to expose the hypocrisy in the language, but at the same time we have to fight against a lot of sneering and laughing at us. We have to try to speak a language that is understood, and we also have to work incredibly hard to always get our point across. You must remember we only have 9% speaking time of the parliamentary speaking time, so when we talk about the deployment of these missiles, we usually get not more than 10 minutes compared to an hour and a half by the Secretary of Defense. So the situation is not very easy, even if you're in parliament.
What are some of the most dramatic and effective actions that have been organized by the Greens?
One I think is very good is a spin that we try to go beyond systems and boundaries and ideologies. So, for example, we protest very heavily against the Turkish military regime by not only going to Turkey, but also by doing all sorts of actions like tying ourselves in a cage to a fence at the Chancellor's office to show that there's a prison system, that there's a dictatorship within NATO. At the same time, we have no problems also in going over to East Germany. General Bastian, myself, and other friends of mine, a group of five, have gone and done this in May, and we have gone to the Alexanderplatz to demonstrate in our way of spontaneity. We were taken to prison, and we were again let go in a very hypocritical way, saying, oh, we didn't know who you were. Had we only known, we wouldn't arrest you. And when we come back, we realize that always the one side applauds us for doing it in the Eastern Bloc, but when we do it at home, they're not applauding it. So the hypocrisy of both power systems is shown in those actions. We have also organized the tribunal, which is for me a very good success, because in Nuremberg, where there has been the war crimes tribunal in regard to the Americans and Germans, we have organized a three-day tribunal inviting people from America, from the Soviet Union, ethical, moral, and scientific and political reasons presented against these weapons. And we have come to the conclusion that any use, deployment, or production of mass destructive weapons is contrary to international law and is criminal.
Do you think that the people in the Greens are united on the issue of feminism within the party? Is there equality between men and women? And do men fully understand and support feminist issues?
Well, I've been kind of a spokeswoman for a long time for the Green in that sense, and I have often criticized that the Green Party is really has a lot of still old chauvinist people in that sense, that even Green men, some of them, in fact it's many I think, have not yet understood that if they're fighting against the big war, against the big oppression of countries being exploited, they must also see the little war, they must never forget it. And some of those Green men, who are very good at theory, are very bad in putting it to practice. So we do have a problem. We try to prevent it by having a, not a rule, but a guideline of having 50% women in the candidates list and also in running for offices at the regional level. So far we have 10 women in the group of 28. That's better than any other party, but it's still not good enough. We do have many women leading in leadership positions, but they have to fight awfully hard. And there's a lot of envy, a lot of jealousy of Green women who are competent. In fact, that envy and that jealousy is sometimes very disappointing, because men have to learn, even in the Green Party, to give up privileges if they really mean it well with their own feministic attitude. And we do feel that women must become much more competent on many issues, and men must get a lot more intuition and emotion. And even in the Green Party, that really portrays that imagery of feminism and ecology, it is a very difficult thing, a very difficult thing. And I only keep hoping that men begin to realize that everything is interconnected, and that their struggle against atomic weapons has a lot to do with phallocratic thinking, has also to do with rape on the street. And when they start making that connection, then we are coming toward a feminist goal.
Has there ever been a group of feminists who split from the Greens because of frustration with feminism?
Well, there have been scenes at national congresses of the Green where women have really cried because they couldn't take the floor because the men wouldn't let them, where they felt that they have been kind of outnumbered in doing the economic program, where they in fact had been ignored, and they had to take really public action to get their voices back. There has been maybe a few individuals who have left. In general, there's a very bad split, I must mention this to you, in the German feminist movement. For the feminist movement in itself is to a large part very sympathetic with the Green and is in the Green, but the other half is strongly moving toward being drafted, going into the German army, and we reject that. For a woman's values should not be to copy male values, it should be to have their own value, and not to stand beside a man and being able to shoot. And this discussion in Germany has led to quite a big split, because many women feel that equality can only be reached if you can also be the same as a man. And we feel exactly the opposite. We feel that equality means that you have the right to make your own value system, and that you have a right to reject militarism, which is a form of patriarchal system. So even that problem is already discussed very well in the Green, where we do have a strong movement to stop German women from being drafted, not drafted, from being put into the army. For there's a big discussion now to open the German army to women. And we hope, we really hope, that German women will refuse that.
Do you oppose the drafting of both men and women into the army?
Yes, we oppose, of course, both. I wish there would be absolutely nobody in any army. We first of all try to make a consciousness-raising effort for... There are now 50,000 draft resistors in Germany. That is quite a high number. Last year was only 30,000. And we try to also point out that women and men have a much better chance to serve society when they do, in fact, social work. What is happening in Germany now is that the social work for a conscientious objector is being extended longer than the period of duty in an army. So it shows how unfair the state reacts, because the right of war resisting is a German basic right.
I know a lot of Americans who support the women being in the military, first of all, support women's right to serve if they desire, but also say if you think that the military system, the way it stands, is unjust, then women and men should fight together to change that system, but women shouldn't be excluded from it if men are forced to serve. What do you think about that logic?
Well, it's like, I think, like asking a cleaning lady at ITT to change the multinational company. It's, to me, rather difficult to try to say that women should join the army to try with men to change it. I think armies always kill, armies always repress, and a woman in any army, if she ends up ever in a position of influence, becoming a colonel or general, I've met a lot of those women at West Point, I met them at the Pentagon, they don't end up trying to change the army. They end up, like Mrs. Thatcher, taking over male values and becoming better men than the men. And I think it's very dangerous to tell women, you must have your equal rights and your equal duties, for they have paid taxes, they have given life to children, they sent children away to armies and into wars, and they've done enough for war and for these causes. So I think women must really collectively say we reject the system of militarism regardless of where it is and whom it serves, and we try much rather to do civil defense, social defense, in the sense of defending your values, defending your value system, and not joining the army. The connections we have made with women in the Belgian army and the Israeli army has been that they in fact become better men, and that is really sad.
Petra Kelly is my guest, and she's a founding member of the Green Party, and she's currently a speaker in West Germany's parliament. She's in Philadelphia to speak this evening at a demonstration that will take place against the planned deployment of NATO nuclear missiles in West Germany. And that demonstration is scheduled from 7:30 to 9:30 on the Art Museum steps in Philadelphia. What is the legacy of World War II in Germany now? And do you think that there's a split amongst the generations in views of like nonviolence and what tactics should be?
Well, the legacy is that, of course, many Germans, including many elderly Germans, are really awoken to the fact that they are responsible for 20 million dead in the Soviet Union, that they have died due to the Germans, and that there has been always a warmongering attitude in Germany, and that Germans have always followed the leader, have always been obedient and orderly and clean, and that now there's a very disorderly factor of politics, of the Green Party being a restless factor and trying to take to the street into the parliament, and trying to say that parliamentary democracy is not made in parliament. It is, in fact, made in the grassroots, in the movement, and the stronger this movement is, the stronger it will be in parliament. There's also a big discussion now, thank heavens, in fact, because the discussion on nonviolence and on violence is very important. It has never been led in the parliament before. We have now a constitutional judge, Helmut Simon, who has said quite clearly there are differences between moral and legal questions, and that at one point the legality of, for example, blocking a street and breaking the law of that traffic law is maybe less important than not breaking the law of life, in fact trying to stop a deployment of a missile system. So he's put a very important question. He says, how many questions can be voted upon? Questions of life and death cannot be decided by any majority. They must be according to your conscience. And that's the same as if the death sentence was now suddenly introduced in Germany. So, in fact, what we try to find in Germany now is to find a way that civil disobedience and nonviolence is an accepted way also in a democratic society. The German government tries to make it look as violence, but at least we have your tradition in this country, Cesar Chavez, Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King, and it shows to us that nonviolence makes a democracy stronger.
My understanding is that most of the people who are members of the Green Party are between the ages of 20 and 40, which means most of the Greens didn't serve in any way during the Second World War, but probably had parents who did. Are there a lot of splits between people in their 20s to 40s now and their parents who served under Hitler during the Second World War?
Well, first of all, it's true that many young people are in the Green Party, but there's also a big segment of elderly people. So we have, in fact, in Bavaria, completely different population structures in the Green, where we have a large portion being over 60 because they're the very committed Christians. So in big towns, you will get the young people. In rural regions, you will get the elderly, and you're missing the 40 to 60. You're missing this kind of successful generation. But there is a definite problem with the generations. At least now, though, I think through this deployment debate, we're coming together, we're talking to each other. It was a very moving sight to be in Mutlangen and to see people like William Baum at 88 and Heinrich Böll and people of that age, Gollwitz, the very famous names of resistance against Hitler, and coming with young people together to resist now new missiles. So, in fact, the gap is being closed through this experience. And many elderly women who built up Germany after the war are now frightened to see it all torn up again, for at that time, they were needed and they were equal. And as soon as society got richer and better, they were put back into the kitchen. So they're very aware of what is happening.
It's sometimes said that Americans don't have the same understanding of war because, except for the Civil War, there hasn't been one fought on our soil. That's not true of Germany. There's been many wars fought there, and certainly World War II demolished a good deal of the country. Do you think that connection with war has helped to build the strength of the nonviolent movement now?
Well, definitely.
That memory of it?
We don't want to make any fear, and we don't want to create fear. In fact, the fear is being created by the other side. For example, when NATO is now practicing mass burials, as it has been doing in Hanau, practicing how to bury soldiers in plastic sacks, then they are, in fact, are making fear. But there is definitely a feeling in German society, though I'm also of the post-war generation, but a definite feeling that there should never be from German ground another war fought. And the fact that we're getting Pershing 2s put on our front step in a very densely populated Germany, threatening again the Soviet Union, isn't a very good feeling. And we're wondering, in fact, why are we the combat zone again? Why is it again that it's happening here? And I'm sure the people in East Germany, many of whom we are in contact, are asking the same thing. Why are they going to be asked to perhaps deploy SS-20s for the Soviet Union? So, in fact, Germany is again at the center of these conflicts.
In the 60s and early 70s, when the war in Vietnam was going on, and a lot of American men didn't want to fight in the war and perceived it as being unjust, they filed for conscientious objector status and for other statuses that would register their objection to it. And for people who were pacifists or perceived as pacifists, the question was always raised, well, sure, it's easy to say you're nonviolent, but do you think nonviolence would have stopped Hitler during World War II? And that was a question you'd hear a lot posed to people in debates, on talk shows, all over. How do you react to a question like that?
Well, first of all, nonviolence is very easier to do when there's a majority of people behind it, when many people are for it. Hitler's Germany was not a country where the majority was against Hitler. The big majority was for Hitler. So nonviolence was very dangerous to do and very difficult to do. The group called Weiße Rose, White Rose, tried to do it, a group of students that were murdered and hung by Hitler. On the other hand, Daniel Ellsberg asked a very important question at the tribunal in Nuremberg. He asked, what would have happened if 200,000 Germans had laid down on the tracks going to Auschwitz and had stopped the trains? That question has never been answered by history. And if there had been a strong nonviolent movement of social democrats, of women, of workers at the very beginning of Hitler, I'm sure fascism could have been stopped.
So you think if nonviolent movements grew up and all the countries that were potential aggressors, then there couldn't be a war.
Well, I definitely think that Germany would have had to try to stop definitely him because, you know, he got elected and he was in fact carried by the industrialists. He was carried by a large portion. But if you look at the countries in the Nordic region, Sweden and Norway, you do see incredible forms of nonviolence. When, for example, the king in one of the Nordic countries marched with a Jewish star and said, I'm also one of the Jews. There was in Holland an incredible amount of resistance. But at that time already it had been too late. And that's always the message of nonviolence. You must begin it at a very early stage. And you must become trained in it in a democratic form. You must have communication. Fascist structures, of course, make it very difficult. Atomic bombs in this fascist age of atomic bombs make it also difficult once you have an atomic explosion to react nonviolently because you're gone. But I think the question must be answered. It must be answered in a context now where we realize what is happening and we can't wait 20 years and say we should have done something 20 years ago.
The Green Party is identified with a countercultural movement. Can you describe what that counterculture is like? I've heard it compared to the counterculture that flourished here in the 60s. I don't know how accurate that is.
Well, counterculture is in Germany meaning a lot of things. It means women building up their own houses for battered wives. It means little shops and book shops and tea rooms growing all over the neighborhood. It means working with Turkish and Greek workers to help educate their children, to make it easier. It means building up self-help networks where, for example, women don't go to the normal clinics anymore. They build up their own self-help clinic, for example, in Berlin, where we have over 1,000 different self-help centers. And so it's a republic within a republic. It's creating a kind of new network of help and of solidarity in a very sterile, consumer-oriented Germany. So this counterculture is already becoming a threat because many different industries are able not to sell the products like they used to. People are more conscientious about buying a television or a car. And what is very good, that there's a kind of consumerism movement to not buy useless things, to not buy cheap things, to buy durable items. And it's also very good that people are going back to repair shops, refusing to throw away any products. So it has a good impact on trying to look at renewable resources, looking at how systems are used. And workers, finally, are beginning, very many of them, are beginning to question, well, why am I sitting here making a part for a Argentinian nuclear power plant? There are not many, but there are some already thinking about converting it to social useful products. So at least it is a very, very big conscious change. But of course, it isn't enough yet to force multinationals into changing their system. At least, though, we have a big advantage now that we have so many books and so much media really kind of talking about this counterculture and showing its force. And I'm sure that consumer boycotts could be very, very effective.
Is there a difference in image and clothes of the people in the counterculture as opposed to the mainstream? I've seen photographs of people demonstrating, men with long hair, yes, similar to hippies.
Well,
in
fact,
America.
It becomes very similar everywhere you go. Sometimes I tend to think we tend to become so oriented toward it that we all end up kind of fashionably dressing as an alternative. And I sometimes get a little upset over it, that sometimes the room to be yourself, the way you are, isn't left anymore. But there is definitely a trend toward making your own clothes, toward using only cotton materials. Men suddenly are found knitting in the Green Party, which is an unusual picture, and women are found also knitting, so we all knit. But there's also a definite feeling that people are taking more time to think about what jobs they're going to take, what education they're going to put their children in, what schools, what kind of peace education are they getting. So at least in this new generation of the 20s to the 35, there's an incredible difference in how they look at life and in how they want to earn their money. And yet, at the same time, there's still a large part of the population, many young people, who either are becoming kind of dropouts and who say, I have no future. The Green are also established, and I don't want anything to do with them. I'm a punk, and I just quit. Or there's also those who still, for a large majority, look for their career and try to have a very decent, established life. So we're reaching many people. I would say the sympathy is with about 10 million people in Germany, where we have 60 million inhabitants.
Is there ever any concern that long hair and casual clothing will alienate people from the mainstream who might otherwise share the Green Party's view of nuclear issues and ecology?
Well, it's been often written to us, that people should cut their hair and they should cut their beards. On the other hand, we found it to be rather disgusting when you look at men in three-piece suits in the German parliament, very well ironed and regenerated by their wives, coming there without a worry and a care, and snickering and cursing and using the vilest language against women in the parliament, against men who were with us. And they then make comments like, go and get a haircut, to some of our members. We feel, that if Jesus had walked into parliament, they would probably have treated him the same way, snickered and sneered at him for his long hair and for his clothing.
You've been quoted, this is a slogan, I think, of the Green Party, that we are not the left nor the right, we are in front. How do you keep from being identified as a left or right group? I think in America you're perceived as a left group. I don't know if that's true in Germany as well.
Well, it's perceived here, I think, in both ways. Mr. Winokur of the New York Times has always tried to make us into a right-wing nationalistic group, and others have tried to make us into a left-wing group. And we do have a large sector that is saying that they have been politically left. I used to belong to the Young Socialists, so I felt left. But I think leftist policies, any Marxism or any old-style socialism in the tradition of Palme or Brandt, it is meaningless because this socialism has become so alienated. It has become growth-oriented. It has become economically oriented toward nuclear power. We reject it. What we're trying to find is a third emancipated way between capitalism and state socialism, a way that kind of brings the self-determination and the co-determination into it very directly. There's no system yet that has functioned like that, so we really have to bring the burden of proof. But definitely definitely all these systems, we do have even some Marxists in the Green Party, and they still try to sell us some of their Marxist theories, but it doesn't work. Most people turn and realize that it is completely outdated, antiquated. And many women, in fact, are sick and tired to have Marx quoted back to them. So we try to do it in practice and try to forget a lot of this ideology, because ideologies paralyze. And we try to find a third way where ecology is the absolute priority, meaning the interdependency on the planet Earth, and not looking only at what is your own cause, what is your own advantage.
What makes Marxism antiquated?
Marxism, I think, was at the time that it was created a very important ideology. I think Marx created a lot of analysis that is correct. But when you then take the age as it is, where Einstein said very clearly everything has changed except the way of thinking, then Marxism only has, in fact, attached itself to economic views of looking at it. When you then have an ecological destruction ahead of you, you have people being oppressed by not only capitalistic systems, but oppressed just the same by the Soviet system, because if you look at the Third World, they're oppressed by any system. Then you realize that you have to bring both of them out of the alienation. A worker in Leningrad and a worker in Detroit and a worker in Germany, they have everything in common. And I think that none of the systems have liberated them. And what they have, in fact, to do is they themselves have to begin thinking, what do I produce? For whom do I produce? And why am I doing it? And when that change has come about, it's not something that Marx had argued for. He didn't argue for this type of self-autonomy and self-determination. And I think Marx didn't have much to say in that sense also about women. I think women have become very aware that all of the theorists of the, so to speak, ages before us, except for the women who are, of course, never known, they're never really talked about, like Alexandra Kollontai, Rosa Luxemburg, they are becoming important again. For it was the women of those times, like Rosa Luxemburg, who have said, or Emma Goldman, the tolerance of listening to the other, the tolerance of his views must be important, and you must always try to develop democracy to the point that you can make your points known and your views known, but you can never infringe upon the other, never repress him in his views. And, of course, this is what we're trying to learn. And the idea that feminism is, I think, a way of the future, because it is ecology. So we're looking toward women who have told us that years ago and not toward men.
You've been active in the West European feminist and peace movement since the early 1970s. When you think back, are there any events in your life that helped bring you to those movements? Is there anything that you can pinpoint as making you a feminist or making you an activist?
There are two important things. My whole idea of coming to the anti-nuclear movement, because I returned back to Germany, which is my home and where I do feel I belonged, is that my sister died of cancer and had been at the age of 10 nearly treated like a Hiroshima patient, being radiated to death by medical radiation, which is a part of the vicious cycle of radiation. It made me question all of the ills of radiation and of chemical and hazardous materials. And then, of course, a very big moment was for me to be in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and to realize that the Americans had already dropped the bomb, that, in fact, no other nation has done so, but that Mr. Truman did so, and that this death of many civilians has never been in a way worked out by the society. They are still second-class citizens, the Hiroshima victims. And also a very big event was for me working 12 years as a civil servant in a 98% male bureaucracy in Brussels in the economic market, common market, and seeing that those men who did policies, social and family policy, economic policy, were so far removed from the real life that my being there, those 12 years now where I've kind of done a double life, have been to me the most important years of finding out how corrupt policies become when people are no longer connected to their grassroots, when they have alienated themselves completely. So those have been those three marking stones of my life that have made me become so committed.
You've been getting a lot of publicity in America, and I'm sure in Germany as well. I know there's sometimes a lot of conflict between movements, between wanting people who are visible so that your movement gets attention, but also feeling that the, quote, star system can be very destructive if you're trying to build a grassroots non-hierarchical system. What's that been like for you navigating between the two?
Well, on the first hand, I do have a lot of solidarity from the Green grassroots membership. The problem comes when the leaders of certain local chapters, who are also striving to become speaker, have problems because, first, I'm a woman, and second, I'm selective about the press. I have taken the right to decide with whom I want to speak, and I just recently, 2 days ago, refused to speak to an editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer because he was impolite. I refused him and I hung up. That is my way of also being my own person and having my own right not to infringed upon. I also feel that in the Green Party, there must be a kind of conflict resolution for the Green Party. is, of course, always trying to make sure it gets its points across. And I happen to speak several languages, so they do send me out a lot. And when they send me out a lot, at the same time, you get criticized a lot. But it has to be resolved, especially among women, because women have to be doubly better and doubly good than men. They have to be more effective, for men have a very high ratio of performance. And it makes me sometimes very angry to see that men who are much less competent feel much more competent. And as soon as a woman speaks up, they must know it better in the end. And so we try to resolve it by saying all green have the right to, of course, go to the press and make press comments, can write their own press releases, and they should travel as much as they can, and they should try to get as much support as they can. So in fact, we don't have really a system of you can go and you can't go. Everybody is free to do it. And I just happen to maybe dedicate a large portion of my life to it. But I also try not to speak to any right-wing media. And I think that's something that we should all adhere to, not speaking to boulevard press, to people who have misused us. And that is a very clear rule in my life, that I will not speak to a press that is in fact repressive to women. I will not speak to papers if I know that advance that is in fact against the green. For I think that we have at least the choice of selection. Media is usually very anti-green. It's usually very anti-female. So in fact, it makes it easy. And if I do get a very repressive gentleman on the television, I've done this often before, I've even threatened to walk out of the program if I feel he's not taking me serious. And I think we must educate the media that they cannot misuse us as a piece of flesh or as a piece of political something. They must realize that we have our dignity and that we will only speak to those who treat us with dignity.
The West German press, as well as the American press, is probably going to be covering all of today's activities, the visit of President Carstens, as well as the demonstration planned this evening that you'll be participating in. What effects do you think it's going to have back in Germany, the kind of press coverage that you get today? I don't mean you personally, but,
right.
the whole scene of events in Philadelphia.
Well, I hope not the same effect that Ron Dellums had, for Ron Dellums came 3 weeks ago to Germany as a congressman. He's also speaking tonight. He spoke in front of 2,000 people, in front of 7 television cameras and about 80 journalists, and one line was reported. And when in Krefeld the demonstration was of 40,000, they weren't reported either. So maybe it's more fair here that, in fact, both of the celebrations, the one of Mr. Carsten and the one of the peace movement, will be reported and given equal time. At least they should be given equal time in the media. I have a strange feeling that in Germany the demonstrations here will not receive the same attention as the visit of Mr. Carsten's.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us on Fresh Air. It's been very interesting. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Petra Kelly has been my guest, and she's a speaker in Parliament now from the Green Party. She's one of 28 Greens who are currently in West Germany's Parliament. And she is, of course, a founding member of the party. She's in Philadelphia to speak this evening at a witness that's being planned. It's a demonstration against the planned deployment of nuclear missiles, NATO missiles, in West Germany. The demonstration is scheduled from 7:30 to 9:30 this evening at the Art Museum steps, and other West German and American peace activists will speak. The demonstration is being organized by a coalition of peace groups and religious groups from several countries. For more information, you can call 568-0917. That's 568-0917. And of course, today, U.S. Vice President George Bush and West Germany's President Karl Carstens are in Philadelphia to celebrate the tricentennial of German emigration to America. Petra Kelly, thank you again for being with us. It's 10 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY FM in Philadelphia. In just a few minutes on Fresh Air, I'll be speaking with Dr. Sidney Wolfe. He's the co-founder with Ralph Nader of the Public Citizens Health Research Group, and they do a lot of research into the safety and effectiveness of drugs and foods, and they also do research on the safety in the workplace. He's written a new book called Over-the-Counter Pills That Don't Work, and that will be the subject of our conversation when he joins us. We'll also open up the telephones for your questions and comments. This Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, we'll be featuring interviews with two women who left Germany in the 1930s to come to America. We'll hear from photographer Lottie Jacoby, who at the age of 87 has become an internationally celebrated photographer, and Lise Manette, who was Lottie Lenya's accompanist and musical advisor for many years and was also a good friend of Lottie Lenya's husband, composer Kurt Weill. Let's listen to one of Lottie Lenya's recordings of a song written by Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht. This is the Barber Song from the Threepenny Opera.
Einst glaubte ich, als ich noch unschuldig war, und das war ich einst grad so wie du. Gewiss kommt auch mal zu mir einmal einer, und dann muss ich wissen, was ich tu. Und wenn er Geld hat, und wenn er nett ist, und sein Kragen ist auch werktags rein, und wenn er weiß, was sich bei einer Dame schickt, dann sage ich ihm nein. Da behält man seinen Kopf oben und man bleibt ganz allgemein. Sicher scheint der Mond die ganze Nacht, sicher wird das Boot am Ufer losgemacht, aber weiter kann nichts sein. Ja.